Let me thank you, Raphael, for that introduction. That's one of the best introductions I've ever had. I get a lot worse. Well, first of all, let me say I'm very grateful to be invited here. I'm recording the talk. This is not as a warning to anyone here who says anything afterwards, but just in case, I regularly record my talks and they're on my website. So if you want to hear this again, and you can, you're perfectly free to contact me and so forth. I'm going to use the board here. You can contact me at this address. Okay, s.w.fuller@warwick.ac.uk. The topic that I want to talk about today is one that I think is very important for social epistemology, however you understand that idea, but really is only being developed now. Wow, okay.
Those are pretty faint.
I know. Might as well not do it, huh?
Do
you have anything?
No, I think I left it in my room.
Okay, all right. Epistemic justice.
Yeah.
Is the title. Okay, should I just go on or wait?
I can't read that in front.
You can't read it, huh? Yeah, no, I can't read it either.
Try this one.
Okay, okay.
I'm not sure if it's better.
Okay.
That's much better.
Is that better? Okay. Okay. So, the topic is epistemic justice. What I want to propose is that there are at least two ways of thinking about this concept. I actually used this expression back in the 1990s, early 1990s, in some of my earlier books. But within analytic social epistemology, there is now this expression of epistemic injustice, which is popular. Okay? At first I hadn't noticed the distinction, but I think the distinction is an important one. Let me start with the analytic epistemology notion, because I think that's a simpler notion. It's one that's due to Miranda Fricker, who's a British philosopher. And her idea basically is epistemic injustice is committed when you do not, when in some sense, the social background of someone is held against them, so they're not treated as credibly as they ought to be treated. Okay? And we understand that idea, I think. Now, the interesting thing is that it's a very strange position for social epistemology to begin from, to sort of treat that as the issue, because the question that one really wants to ask is, what is the basis for credibility in the first place, from which we can then say, let's say, people from disadvantaged backgrounds aren't given the sort of credibility they ought to have. So in other words, by calling this a problem of epistemic injustice, there's a certain kind of political correctness involved. Namely, we start off by assuming, yes, we all know who the disadvantaged people are, and in some way that has to be addressed. But then what is the issue of advantage, right? What is the other side of the, what is being presupposed here as the norm? And from my own standpoint, the way I approach the notion of epistemic justice is to basically say that epistemic justice is about reducing the power effects of knowledge. Okay, that is to say, the extent to which having knowledge enables you to exercise power over others in society. So epistemic justice is about democratization. Okay, and then that's sort of very much up front with me. Now, why is this an important issue? Well, it's quite clear, right, that the reason why women, blacks, minorities, etc., discriminated against in terms of their knowledge not being taken seriously, is because of the sort of people they are. That's understood. Okay, no dispute about that. The question then becomes, what is the positive story here? What does epistemic justice mean? And what are we aiming for at the end of the day? And there are two different ways in which one might think about where the problem lies. And both of these are sort of in the analytic social epistemology literature, but they're rarely expressed as such. And let me just, I'm going to put this on the board here. What exactly is not being represented in epistemic injustice? Is it that certain people are not being heard, or is it that certain perspectives are not being heard? They're not the same thing. Right, so in other words, is the problem, for example, that women or blacks are not being taken seriously as people? In the sense that, you know, once you see that someone's a black or a person or a woman, you do not take their knowledge claim seriously? Or is it rather the content of what they say that is being suppressed? In which case, does it matter that it is them expressing it? Okay, do you see the difference here, right? There are certain perspectives that are traditionally or historically, or maybe you might even say biologically, I don't know, but in any case, there are certain perspectives that are attached to certain people. Right? But what is it that really matters here? The people or the perspectives that are being suppressed? Okay, that's an issue here, because I think there's a tendency in the way in which, in our political correctness ways, to think of these two things together. You know, to give you an example of where I think this kind of thing is kind of it becomes interesting is, let's say you look at the women of who become professors despite all of the sort of oppression and suppression and so forth of males in institutionalized politics of academia and elsewhere, and you look at the first generation of the women who succeed to be professors, and then you pose to them, well, you know, we need a certain kind of affirmative action to enable more women to get in, and so we're going to reserve 30 or 40% of places for women. Those women often object to that, okay, because they don't think it's just about the people, in a way, right? It's not just about the people. And I think this is a very important kind of question with regard to social epistemology, because what is it exactly that we need to represent? So, for example, if very often, in terms of talking about epistemic justice, the name of John Stuart Mill gets mentioned. And John Stuart Mill is someone who believed that there should be, you know, everyone should have their opinions voiced, right, and that in fact, the, you know, free and open exchange of views made publicly would be the way by which society could get at the truth. Right? This is John Stuart Mill's view. This is a very kind of liberal sort of social epistemology. Everybody in the field, including myself, loves this view. But what is he saying exactly? He's not necessarily saying that every perspective ought to have indefinite view. He believes every person should be able to speak their mind, regardless of what they think. Okay? And so, for example, John Stuart Mill was very much against the idea of class-based voting. And he was very much against the idea, he believed that everybody, ideally, should speak their mind openly. Everybody should see what everybody says. And then that should be the basis for a judgment. So he was trying to basically say, look, individuals have to make judgments for themselves. He didn't want to associate that with a particular kind of perspective. And so The issue here has to do a lot not only with being able to represent the different points of view in society, the kind of pluralist argument for social epistemology. It's not just about that, but there's also an issue about how those different views interact with each other. And this is where the issue of the people becomes important. Because you have to imagine that people are entities whose perspectives may change over time as a result of interacting with each other. Okay, so you do not want to identify people too closely with the perspectives. Okay, so women may in fact have been disadvantaged in the past because they are women, but it doesn't follow that all of those women hold the same views, or if they were actually allowed to speak their minds, their views would be so radically different from others. There are different issues. These are separate, as it were, empirical issues. But there's a tendency to sort of think of these things as linked. Okay? And I do think that there, that in terms of a social epistemology, one has to be, you know, thinking about, well, what is it that you're actually trying to promote with your social epistemology from a normative standpoint? And what you do, what you want, I think the John Stuart Mill goal is a good goal, that you want everybody's voice to be heard and to be heard equally, but also not to be presumed that they already represent something. Okay? Because the discrimination came about because it was presumed that women or blacks were not eligible because of the sorts of things they represented. And it seems very often that the way to remedy this is to treat them as if they do represent those things, but they need to be represented. Okay? I mean, and so I do think this is a very tricky kind of issue, but it's one that I think that social epistemology needs to deal with in order to talk about knowledge as not only a social system, but one that's dynamic and changing. Because I think one of the problems that social epistemology can very easily get into is this, it's a kind of the rut of political correctness, where in a sense you want the knowledge formations of society to mirror sort of what people already believe. And often the sorts of things that pass for pluralism are of that kind. Okay? Now, you know, one of the reasons why I'm saying all this is because I think that sometimes people imagine that if you take the sociological view of knowledge seriously, that somehow you're a relativist. Okay, I'm not a relativist. Okay, I wouldn't be talking about this if I were a relativist. If I were a relativist, right, I would say, okay, there's a women's view, there's a black's view, right, and these things have their own views for their own selves, and they need to be respected as such. But what I'm supposing is people may start off with those positions, but we cannot, as it were, reify them, right? We have to assume that there's some way they can interact with each other, that possibly people might change their minds as a result. And so it becomes then very important that one separates the people who are the thinkers, the decision makers, from the particular views that they hold at any given moment. Those things have to be kept separate if you're going to have an adequate dynamic social epistemology, one that can actually learn from the collective experience. And this is something I think that John Stuart Mill realized. Okay, but I don't think it's really quite clearly acknowledged in a lot of the stuff that is called social epistemology now. Okay? So that's one part of the issue of epistemic justice and injustice. I mean, I think one way, you know, there is actually a concrete context in which this kind of issue makes, you know, is alive now, and that is, you may know that there is this issue of the extinction of languages, right? That most of the languages of the world are going to become extinct because the people who normally speak them are not around anymore. Well, there's a question about what are we to do about that?
Does it, you know, and so the idea is you might want to preserve the languages. But to preserve the languages, do you actually need to have particular people speaking them? Right? In other words, do they have to be people who, as it were, come from the places where the languages originally were? And the answer is no, of course. Right? That in fact, the places where some of these languages are being preserved the most, you know, are places like the University of Chicago, right? Where you get like all sorts of languages being taught and preserved and so forth, whereas the original native speakers have disappeared a long time ago. Okay? So there's a difference here between the issue of preserving the perspectives and preserving the people. So that's one point about the issue of epistemic justice. Now there's another issue too about epistemic justice, which comes up in a sort of policy context. And that has to do with whether, well, what do you take to be the default setting of the way in which knowledge is produced now? So for example, we have science here. Science is normally regarded as the most valued form of knowledge for various reasons, because it's tested, because it's organized. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons for it. Now, the question arises as to how valid should we take science to be normally, and in the following sense. Do we suppose that scientists normally catch major problems, major errors, in the knowledge that they produce? Do we or don't we? Okay. As you know, there's been an increasing case of scientific fraud that's been reported. Right? And there's some sense in which this causes a problem for the knowledge system in general because, you know, the public trusts science, and so it assumes that the scientific enterprise is operating at a certain level normally that's very sort of high validation, trustworthy, etc. But now you get these incidents of fraud. Does this indicate that the scientists are not able to regulate themselves? Okay. And so there's an issue about the default setting about how well the knowledge system is working. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning this is because within the philosophy of law and the theory of law in general, there are two sorts of legal systems that one can talk about. They get called by many names, but I call them inquisitorial and accusatorial. And this has to do with what is the default setting about the validity of knowledge that science normally produces. The inquisitorial setting is to presume the worst, right? In other words, to presume that scientists are just doing what they can get away with. And so that what you want is some independent outside body to check to see whether all the views are being represented adequately, whether the theories are being tested properly, and so forth. Because in this respect, science is like any other self-contained body, and it's, you know, susceptible to the same kinds of problems and so forth. And so you want to have independent checks coming in from the outside. The accusatorial system, in contrast, believes that all of the problems will arise from within the system and resolved within the system. In other words, you do not need some kind of meta-level agency to look at what scientists are doing. Rather, within the scientific community itself, there will be people complaining about things, but they can be resolved within the normal channels. So if something that you have put forward gets rejected, you can appeal, and within the science system you can get some kind of resolution because the issues involved aren't systemically biased or prejudiced or fraudulent. Now,
a lot of what's been going on in the developments in the philosophy of science over the last 30, 40 years can be understood in this way, in terms of this distinction. So if you look at something like the sort of philosophy of science of people, well, Karl Popper would be the most important example, but others as well, right? Very much a sort of the inquisitorial line, where there's a sense in which the role of the philosophy of science is as the inquisitor, right? Where there's a sense in which the philosopher of science, in a way, looks at the whole history of science and looks at whether, in fact, things have been dealt with fairly, right? Whether certain issues have not actually been adequately voiced, or whether things have been believed on the wrong grounds, and whether certain decisions from the past need to be reversed or opened up or reviewed again, right? So if you think of people like Popper or Lakatos or Paul Feyerabend even, right? All of these people could be fit into that inquisitorial category in the sense that they have a kind of independent standpoint where in a sense they are saying, well, you know, science is supposed to be living up to these kinds of standards. And this is the basis on which we consider it the most important form of knowledge. But you actually have to look and see whether the scientists themselves are living up to it. It's an independent job. You cannot assume the scientists themselves do it. The scientists perform science, but they don't own science. Right? Because science, given the status of knowledge that it has, right, has to do with its authority over society. Okay, and the question is, do the scientists merit that? Do they deserve that? And this requires an independent check. It is not self-certifying. A scientist may be able to tell another scientist whether they're performing a certain kind of experiment well or poorly, but whether it counts, you know, as the most, you know, as the knowledge that should be taken seriously in a given domain is an independent question. It's about the status of the knowledge. Okay? And so philosophers of science traditionally have been very much in this inquisitorial mode. And one of the things that I've argued in many of my works and mainly in the stuff having to do with Thomas Kuhn, because you may know I've written a lot about Thomas Kuhn, that the kind of people who we historically have called philosophers of science, so whether we're talking about like William Whewell or Pierre Duhem or Ernst Mach, all these guys from the 19th century, one of the things that they had in common was they were all scientifically trained, but they were losers. They were losers, right? They were on the losing side of all the major theoretical issues of their day. This is very common, okay? And part of what these people were up to in terms of the general frameworks they come up with, right, and the general sort of meta-level understandings of science, is a kind of a sense of trying to balance the books, right? So in other words, these people never were convinced that they were losers, right? They believed that, as it were, the scientific community went the wrong way, and that they were, as it were, coming up with criteria that could sort things out. Okay? And this is the thing. I mean, I think there's a tendency very often when we look at these philosophers of science from the 19th century especially, right, we just look at, as it were, what they say about the philosophy, and we forget about how does that relate to the actual scientific views they had. And these guys were the losers. Because the winners don't have to talk about philosophy of science. They just do science and they pass as scientists. But the philosophers of science have to explain something. They have to understand, they have to make sense of something at a higher level. And so it then becomes very natural to sort of say, something went wrong here. And actually this does, I mean, and look, and this is not just rationalization. It's not just rationalization like, oh, I lost, therefore I'm going to have sour grapes. It's not a sour grapes thing. It's different, right? Because in a sense, you know, you look at somebody like, you know, Ernst Mach, for example. Ernst Mach had no impact on physics. Was definitely a loser. Didn't believe in atoms, all that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, the way in which,
you know, he kind of conceptualized his criticism, influenced people like Einstein and Heisenberg and all these people who eventually did make the scientific revolution. So they're sort of out of step by a generation or two. Okay? And so I think that's a kind of an important point here. So there is this inquisitorial function, and it's not just one that has to do with today's world where we're worried that scientists are committing fraud all the time, but it's one that I think is very ingrained into what the history of the philosophy of science has been about. It's been very much in this inquisitorial mode, where all these people in this tradition have felt something's gone wrong. We need to go back to first principles. And those first principles will then enable us to have some kind of guidance as to where we go in the future. And so you get a kind of recalibration of the history taking place. Okay? So this inquisitorial mode is a very important one. Now the accusatorial mode, I think, is kind of the mode in which we live in now. Because one of the things that has happened with the philosophy of science, starting in the 1980s, which is kind of when I come into the picture, in a way, see, you know, if you want to understand me, right, I'm someone who believes this view, but I sort of came into the picture when this view was arising. Okay, and so we now live in a situation where philosophy of science, it's very impolite or politically incorrect to actually make second-order judgments about science. Okay, I'm about to wind up, actually. That philosophy of science isn't about having second-order judgments that criticize existing science, but rather it's about understanding how the scientists do their business that actually enables them to succeed as well as they do. Okay? Now, the accusatorial mode of justice is associated with the common law tradition. Okay? With you know, what we have in the Anglo-Saxon world. And this kind of judicial system presupposes that, in fact, people normally get along with each other, and that you don't need to interfere with their lives unless someone raises an objection, and then you need a court case. So you presume a relatively self-regulating, self-organizing system where people can resolve their disputes amongst themselves through a peer review system, as it were. And it's only rarely that you need someone from the outside, a judge, to step in to rule. Okay? That's the accusatorial system. Most philosophers of science now, I would say, are sort of in that camp, where in a sense they sort of take for granted that the disciplines kind of organize and understand themselves and how they work reasonably well, except for certain border cases, where then you might need a philosopher to kind of make some judgment on the matter. But otherwise, things are going well, and in a sense, what you want to understand is, how do they manage to go so well? And this is how the philosophy and sociology of science, in a purely descriptive sense, not normative anymore, but descriptive sense, work together. Okay? This is how these things work together. So, in the philosophy of science, if you're familiar with people like Nancy Cartwright and all these people from the so-called Stanford School, Ian Hacking would fit into this too, John Dupre, Peter Galison, because he was at Stanford in the 90s, right? People talk a lot about regional ontologies. Right, the idea that when we talk about science, we shouldn't be talking about science in the whole as a unified thing like the positivists and Popper and all those guys did, but rather we should be talking about science with the small s. Each different science has its own domain, which is its regional ontology. And then to understand how that regional ontology works, right, one needs to be doing empirical work to find out what the scientists are doing, how they're interacting with things, etc., etc. Okay? But there is no unified picture to be had. There is no unified normative picture or even, you know, conceptual theoretical picture to be had. They're just these little domains, and each one has their own governing mechanism, and a philosopher's role in that, right, is basically just to make judgments in the difficult cases. Right? The philosopher has no other kind of oversight function because it's presumed that the science works perfectly well by itself. And this is kind of the peer review notion of science. And you see this all the time, actually. Because not just from philosophers and not just from scientists, but also from policymakers who are very much against intervention. You know, they believe what they talk about is science is a self-correcting mechanism. Right? You may have heard this, right? Self-correcting. Yes, there's a fraud. Yes, there's an error. But it eventually gets found. And it gets found out before too much damage has been done. Right? Within the system itself. Okay. Now, the issue that I want to end it here with is that there's a sense in which if we're going to talk about epistemic justice, we really need to roll out the full range of legal and political issues that this concept implies. Okay? And this involves many different sorts of regimes of regulation, which I don't think have really been talked about very much yet, especially in the analytic side of the literature. Because the analytic side of the literature, in a way, presupposes that knowledge normally is a kind of self-regulating thing, or science is a self-regulating thing, but there are these moments of discrimination where people aren't given the voice they deserve to have because of their perspective. And so then we talk about injustice, you know, as if this was a relatively marginal thing. But in fact, there's a larger discussion to be had in social epistemology about what the nature of epistemic justice is. And this has to do with lots of issues, especially with regard to science. Because nobody denies that science is the most authoritative form of knowledge in society. So if it is the most authoritative form of knowledge in society, then in some sense it is speaking for all of us. Right? In other words, that's the ultimate court of appeal for whatever knowledge claim we make. And so how does one want to make the connection between whatever we're saying now and what that is? Okay, and is it just a matter of people constantly deferring judgment, right? This idea of just saying, well, you know, I don't know for sure, but this other guy who's much, you know, who knows more about this, knows it better than me, I trust him, right? Or is there some job for some sort of systematic oversight over the system, regardless of one's knowledge of the particular area? Okay, so in other words, is there a scope for a sort of general social epistemology, general philosophy of science, that deals with epistemic justice as a whole notion, okay, rather than just, as it were, devolving it down to different regions, different groups to decide what they do? And I happen to believe that there is such a need for a kind of general notion, a kind of general large normative notion. But in order to deal with that idea, okay, then one has to think about normativity a little bit differently from the way in which the analytic social epistemologists do. Because analytic social epistemologists are fixated on truth. And truth is a notion that's not really going to help us with this issue we're talking about here. The issue that's going to help, the normative notion we need to be focusing on is purpose, end, goals, overarching values. What sorts of things do we want to see promoted? And then within those things, we can talk about better and worse ways of promoting certain kinds of values and aims. And in that context, we may be able to talk about truth. But the idea of just truth by itself, as some kind of overarching idea of science, doesn't actually give us enough normative purchase to deal with these issues of epistemic justice at all. It just leaves the question completely wide open. And I'll stop there, okay? And then I'll take discussion and questions. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think I agree with your general aim of having not just a regional philosophy of science, but a general normative philosophy of science that's also a part of social epistemology or connected with it. But you made a historical claim that I don't think is right. You impugned one of my favorite philosophers of science, William Whewell, as a scientific loser.
Yes.
Now, in retrospect, he may look like a loser because he was on the wrong side of the Darwin debate.
Yeah, well, and there are other debates too, but...
The first debate he was involved in was over the calculus, pushing the Leibniz view over the Newtonian view, and he won that one. And he was a sufficiently eminent scientist,
yes,
he coined the term, to become master of Trinity. And so it looks to me that, and I think his major philosophical works were written in the 1840s, which is well before the Darwin debacle. So I don't think, at least what he was doing, his major work in philosophy of science, he would look at all like a scientific loser.
Oh, well, I think, well, I mean, I think he was a loser. And I mean, in the Darwin episode, I think the thing is that he actually applied his own principles to what he thought Darwin was doing. And that's why he ended up concluding against Darwin. Okay? I mean, so I think that there is a sense in which Whewell was always thinking about kind of the longer game, you might say. I mean, I think, you know, to put a kind of positive spin on this, because I do think, historically, look, he was a loser. He did take the wrong side on lots of issues, and that's why he's not remembered primarily as a scientist. He's remembered primarily as a philosopher. In fact, being remembered as a philosopher is like a consolation prize for not being remembered as a scientist. I mean, if you think about Hobbes's exclusion from the Royal Society at the very outset, right? This thing that Chapin and Schaffer talk about in Leviathan and the Air Pump. What is that about? Well, the losers are the people who get called philosophers subsequently, okay? And so I do think that, you know, regardless of what, you know, you can replay Whewell's life all you want, I think, as a matter of fact, we remember Whewell as a philosopher, even though, as you rightly say, this man was trained as a scientist, was an eminent scientist, was very much involved in the science of his day, just like the other people I mentioned were. Okay? But at the end of the day, the legacy turns out to be in philosophy.
But I thought you were making another causal claim, which is that he turned to philosophy because of failures in science.
No. I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to convey that. That I do not mean to convey. I think with all these people, so it's not like Thucydides, okay? So Thucydides is someone who's in the Peloponnesian Wars, is a general for Athens, and gets knocked out in the first round, basically. And so then he sort of spends his time writing about what went wrong, right? No, it's not like that.
Okay, so it's not a psychological claim, it's more a way the history works.
Yes, exactly.
Whewell is a very interesting case, because in his day he was known as a political economist, more than as a philosopher. It's just that the political economy has been superseded and the philosophy hasn't.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, and so you wonder what it... Yeah, but then if you're a naturalist, right, and we're naturalists here, what does that say about philosophy, about in terms of what it means to have longevity as a philosophy in this kind of intellectual environment?
Philosophy's the philosophical problems are so hard that they don't get resolved.
Well, I know, but that's a bit of a self-serving answer, isn't it? I mean, I think there's a sense in which... I do think that there is a question to be asked as to... Because philosophical people who tend to survive as philosophers tend to survive in the culture as second-order thinkers. So in other words, they're people you bring in to provide certain kinds of standards and overarching ways of thinking about first-order things. And so what is going on there? And I tend to think what's happened is that the people who get called the philosophers are people who are, as it were, bringing up issues that were not quite resolved historically. You know, there's still things that even the dominant views did not take care of adequately. So, for example, right, Mill's a political economist. Mill survives in ethics. Ethics, you might say, is the residue of political economy that has, you know, that hasn't quite figured that part out yet, right? The part that's left over is ethics still. If you're a scientist, that's how you'd think about it.
I wouldn't put it that way.
But I'm saying, if you're someone who believes that economics is kind of the science of value, and then you look at the fact that Mill survives as an ethicist, right? What you would say is, well, what Mill is dealing with is the residue of political economy, the part that the political economy cannot deal with, or not yet deal with.
Yeah, that's a little too Whiggish for me, because I think actually that contemporary economics could benefit from looking back to Mill's political.
I agree with you. No, but I think you have that both. No, I agree with you. But I think you need to have both historical perspectives in view when you're doing a normative issue here, because it isn't. Because look, we're philosophers. We're, as it were, it's self-serving for us to think of Mill as capturing something those economists haven't captured, and you know. I mean, because we need to find some subject matter for ourselves.
There was a question, Mr. Yves.
Well, I'm very interested by your opposition between inquisitorial and curatorial. And if we take a curatorial way of dating as a good one, then what is the position of science here, because it's supposed to be a contradictory debate, and so every claim is, say, on the same level. But if you say that we have to examine what are the purpose and the overarching values, then you have to make a choice about hierarchy.
Yes.
And so if we can find again the schema of and the deviation of the inquisitorial schema, because philosophers are maybe not scientists, loser scientists, but maybe loser in the debate, social debate, and trying to defend what are their specific way of thinking of the prioritary values and so on and so forth. So either we have a very democratic conception of the debate, and then the different specificity between what is a scientific argument, what is a moral argument, what, and so on and so forth, are a bit confused, or the philosopher is supposed to say, well, this is a scientific argument, this is an ethical one, and you know it's not the same regimes, and so on and so forth. And you find again a kind of overarching way of doing things that you have criticized for.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a difficult issue. I mean, I think one problem that the inquisitorial view always had within the philosophy of science was that the people who were espousing it, let's say somebody like Karl Popper, never really made very clear the standpoint from which the inquisitor operates from, right? What is the nature from which one can talk about entire science is going the wrong way, regardless of what the scientists themselves say. And I do think this is a kind of a very interesting problem. Because if you go back, let's say, to the 19th century, and you look at someone like Auguste Comte, okay? And I do think that this is someone who, probably here too, but very underestimated figure in terms of the significance of the, of this kind of issue. I mean, Comte had a very clear view about this, right? We're talking about the self-realization of humanity. And science is in the vanguard of that. And the way you judge science is insofar as it promotes that goal. Okay? The self-realization of humanity. And so then you're going to be judging science that way. Now, you have to give some details as to what the self-realization of humanity means, okay? And that's a complicated question. But the point is, that's kind of the overarching goal. So in other words, it isn't simply a matter of you're just doing science because, you know, for its own sake. There's actually a larger goal. There's this goal of realizing what human beings can be. And that then provides the standard from which the inquisitor operates. But see, that issue still leaves open the questions I raised at the beginning of my talk, where I talked about, well, what is of interest here? Is it that we want to hear what every person says, regardless of what they say, or are we interested in every
person's perspective? And I think that's a kind of a more difficult question to figure out. What exactly is this goal of humanity that science is supposed to be serving? Okay, but I do think, in a sense, that social epistemology needs to be moved in that direction. What the sort of thing Larry Loudon talks about is axiology, right? The issue of the values, the aims, right? Because that is very underspecified in this entire discussion. Whether we're talking about the analytic social epistemology or my own, and I think that the word truth is kind of just stuck in there, but doesn't really do any kind of work. So, you know, whatever the answer to the question is about what the aim of knowledge is, truth is not really a very helpful answer. Because everybody wants truth. Who doesn't want truth? All right? I mean, but there isn't a substantive idea there. And I think that that's the main problem. Because otherwise, what you end up doing with the accusatorial system is you basically just treat science as a kind of, a sort of expertise, a kind of guild. You know, here are these people doing these things they were trained to do. They do it very well. We respect it to a certain extent. And it's only when they get into their own problems that we then need to have a philosopher come in and say something. And it seems to me that's way too modest. But that is kind of where philosophy of science is these days. So that's, I guess, how I would answer that. Yeah?
So would you claim that social epistemology has to be subordinate to ethics? That ethics is a much broader framework in which social epistemology has to be thought?
Well, I guess I would, rather than the word ethics, which in analytic in the analytic philosophy, right, ethics and epistemology are seen as different fields normally, and so I would subordinate social epistemology to value theory, which is in a sense a different, a more general kind of idea that predates the distinction between ethics and epistemology and analytic philosophy.
Yes, but in your specific.
Yes.
Justice
is a very broad notion, right? I mean, it's ethics, political philosophy, legal philosophy, right? So within the so that's why I say value theory, right? So I'm really trying to pitch this at a higher level. It's not so. In other words, I don't necessarily have the view that you have to somehow solve the problems of ethics before you solve the problems of epistemology. And in fact, I think the problem is that these two different problems are seen artificially separated, and that we need a general kind of value issue. You see, I don't think what I'm saying is so mysterious. I mean, if you look at, the idealist tradition or the pragmatist tradition, for that matter, those are two traditions where the distinction between ethics and epistemology was never clear. Okay, in where the sense in which, you know, the end of knowledge, right, is a discussion about the kind of person you expect to have once you have knowledge. Right, so it looks like an ethical discussion in some sense. And that's what, you know, and that's kind of what I would like to see us go back toward, is that kind of idea where we talk about ends in a very robust kind of way. Right? Where in a sense, when we talk about an end, we're talking about a specific realizable outcome. Like, what kind of person do you want? Okay? So we pursue all this knowledge, we do all these things, what kind of person results in the end? And if you look at German idealism or American pragmatism, that is what the issue is about at the end of the day. That's why people like Dewey were so concerned about teaching and education. Okay? And that's why with the German idealists, you know, there's all this stuff about education too. It's about the person you become at the end. It's not about what the worldview looks like. It's not about what the picture looks like. But it's about what you look like. And that, I think, blurs the distinction between ethics and epistemology.
So, but pragmatists had very different views. And it seems that you are not so far from John Dewey.
Right. In that respect, yes. I do agree with him. But it's the part of Dewey that overlaps with the idealist tradition. Because Dewey originated as a kind of Hegelian, you may know, right? And didn't change. And I think it's that overlap that's very important. Because, I mean, the interesting thing about epistemology, and social epistemology included, as it is today, is that education as a phenomenon isn't really foregrounded very much. Yet, for these guys it was. Because in a sense what you're trying to do when you're producing knowledge, right, is to produce a kind of person. And that each individual might be able to go through that process. And so, but I do think you need to be able to look at philosophy differently from the way we look at it in analytic philosophy today, where there is this kind of artificial separation of ethics from epistemology, and there really is no general value theory.
Other people, I don't know if you would say that they belong to, they are members of the analytical philosophy movement, but for example, Philip Kitcher would support a view not so far from yours as well. He is not saying that science has just to search for truth, but he's interested in the role of society and politics in suggesting some goals that scientists should have. And he is interested especially in the democratic way of deciding the priorities that science that has to have.
Yeah, but I think he's kind of ambiguous on some of the questions that I've been raising here. In particular, when I was raising this issue in the beginning of the talk about whether what you want are the people represented as individuals versus the perspectives, I think with his view of well-ordered science, he's really interested in perspectives rather than people. And this is why there's no concrete kind of institutional way of bringing it about. And I do think at the end of the day, you have to be kind of clear about how does this proceed as a political project. And my view, and this is why I said at the beginning of the talk, that I believe we should have individual people speaking for themselves, regardless of whether the perspectives are representative, you know, of the groups they are seen to be coming from. Right? You have to allow for more change and more dynamism. And I'm not sure, I don't see how that comes out of Kitcher's view. I mean, I see how Kitcher wants to represent different perspectives, but I don't see how you end up getting a sort of dynamic, changing view of science. I mean, one thing, I'm very attracted to the idea that, whatever view you begin with in the scientific process, you don't necessarily end with that, and you may change your views very radically. And you have to, and the interesting thing about science is how you institutionalize that, so that people don't worry about that they're going to, that there's going to be prejudice against them or something of that kind. You know, so beyond the issue of whether people are allowed to speak, is whether they're allowed to change their minds.
I don't clearly see what it may mean in the concrete life of science. Introducing your view, how does it change things? How science has to be done to fit in with your view?
Well, I think there's something to be said for having elections in science. In other words,
elections,
yes, with regard to theories and stuff. So in other words, if you look at the history of science, You get the impression that radical changes occur when the scientists feel like it, more or less, right, with some interference. But the point is the scientists decide amongst themselves. It isn't something, they aren't asked on a regular basis what they think about fundamental theories and fundamental directions in their field. There isn't a regular accounting for that, okay? And so I would introduce that. In other words, introduce more opportunities for the possibility of radical change, at least radical disagreement to be expressed. Because I don't see it really happening in science in the way in which it's currently constituted, which is a peer review process where people kind of know the rules of the game and they try to get stuff accepted. And then, of course, if enough people don't get stuff accepted and they have enough power, they can break away or change or whatever.
But I'm talking about something different, where on a regular basis, scientists would be asked to make decisions about things of a fundamental nature, so that a disagreement at least is regularly expressed and public. Okay, so it would be much more like a political system in that respect.
So you would have some institutional proposals to do?
Yeah, I would say that would be a useful role for a National Academy of Science to perform, or a professional society. Yeah, I would. We already have these things.
Yes.
Make them useful.
They are not very useful.
No.
Sometimes they do those sorts of polls, like climate change, for example.
Sure, of course. There's opportunistic ways of doing this. But I'm saying on a regular basis, on the fundamental issues of the field, in other words, turn the scientific enterprise into a philosophical ideal. Because, come on, when you and I were students as philosophers of science, we always heard about theory choice. You know, scientists are making decisions about theories, which way to go. Well, in fact, this isn't happening most of the time. This really is not happening. Because people aren't forced into that situation most of the time. People normally can, Kuhn was right in that respect, right? Scientists normally are just following the one theory that has enabled them to publish and get stuff done in the past. And it's only when things get really bad that they're somehow motivated to start thinking about a different way. So he's right about that sociologically, but what I'm saying is, from philosophically, institutionalized points where scientists are forced to say, well, look, are you satisfied with the way things are going now? Are there alternative theories? Should they be given a greater say? And ask scientists explicitly about that point on a regular basis, 3, 4, 5 years, just like an election. You know, and what you do as a result of that, okay, that's an open question, what you do as a result of the information. But to make the information registered on a regular basis, that's the first step to what I'm talking about.
But I don't see concretely what it can mean. What happened in sociology? What would you say about...
Well, look, I think this would first of all provide an incentive for people who consider themselves a member of a discipline to join their professional societies. Okay, because maybe it's true in France, certainly in England, we have a British Sociological Association, but, it's not, it holds meetings, but it's not a very active force, and a lot of people who are called sociologists don't belong to it. And
it's a waste of time.
Exactly, yes, no, I understand completely. But this would be, then provide a reason, because this body would then say, look, we want to know what people who consider themselves members of this field, and you can have criteria by which you are a member of the field, you have a PhD in the subject or whatever, right? And then you're going to be asked these questions, you vote on this matter, this becomes public. That's what I would do. And this would make the professional societies have some kind of normative purpose. Okay? And then you would get a sense of what people think. Because there are, a lot of the claims that are made about the way in which science is operating has a lot to do with just very few people speaking for everybody. Okay? And sociologically, understanding, what scientists think really is a very elusive phenomenon. And so what I would say from a philosophical standpoint, what you want is to ask the scientists on a regular basis the kinds of questions that philosophers think are interesting ones for deciding the way in which science should go. And this is not done. And scientists don't think about what they do the way philosophers do. And I happen to be someone who thinks, well, maybe they should.
That's a good question.
I think you are suggesting a kind of political institution in science in society in which there is a very diffused and spreading over skepticism about political institutions. And so, for example, the climate change group is accused to have a normative view of what would be the right way of doing science and politics, both science and politics. And this, the result is that nobody is really believing robustly in the result of the work of this group.
No, I understand. No, you've got a point there.
I guess my own view is, I guess I am a believer in democratic institutions and in voting and in the checks and balances of different sorts of bodies. I wrote a book that came out 2000 called The Governance of Science. Okay, and in a way, it's an interesting book, you might say, to read alongside of the Kitcher book you were talking about. And I support very much a kind of Republican ideal of science in a very literal sense. And this is where all this stuff comes in about the significance of voting and representation and all this kind of stuff. I think that actually those kinds of mechanisms that were developed in the 18th and 19th centuries are still very good ones. They're not enforced or taken sufficiently seriously. But I do think that those are the ones that we have to work with. And in the case of science, I think the problem is especially bad because science is not used to running in this kind of way, because there's a sense in which the idea of natural hierarchy in science seems to emerge much more easily, right? When we talk about the Matthew effect in sociology, for example, right, where in a sense those who get successful earlier in their careers in various ways continue to be successful, and you get a kind of stratification of people. And I think scientists are all too willing to agree to this, what I think from a political standpoint is a very primitive way of organizing things. It's almost like a dynastic model, right? It's a kind of old style, monarchy, dynastic sort of model that I think modern democratic societies are much more advanced on. And so in that respect, I think science as a social and political organization is sort of behind the times in this way. But I do take your point that there's a lot of skepticism about political institutions today. But I do think that that reinforcing democratic political institutions is the best way to go with regard to the scientific community.
Still, people think that the main problem with the government of science, in a way, is that the question of epistemic independence and the question of epistemic authority cannot be solved by political procedures like voting. Of course, if you're more democratic at the political level, it may not change at all the fundamental problem of science, that it raises a question that epistemic authority are, of course, it's a kind of social authority, but are not a social authority in a classical sense.
Yes. No, I agree with you. In fact, one thing I did not talk about here, it was one of the things I was thinking of talking about, but there is the issue of how one thinks of expertise. Right. So the epistemic dependence issue. I'm someone, you may know this already, but I'm someone who thinks of epistemic dependence as a curse, or something that has to be overcome, not something to be embraced. But I realize it's there. Okay. So I realize it's a fact. But I treat it as a problem rather than as something to embrace. This is where I would, to go back to the issue of the teaching function. In this book, The Governance of Science, most of it is about the university as an institution, actually. Okay? Because the interesting thing is that most people who talk about the governance of science don't really talk about the university as such. I spend most of my time talking about the university. And the key point here is that the university is also a very important part of this democratization process. It's not just about the voting and the political institutions. But it's also about what the university does. And part of what the university does, a very important part, is first of all to make the expertise of particular research more generally available to people who would otherwise not have access to it. So there's some democratization going on there. But there's also an incentive provided within the knowledge system, you might say, to come up with more efficient ways of being able to do the sorts of things that expertise does. You know, so not merely counter expertises, but more efficient things. And so developments of technology, I think this is the most apparent thing, where in a sense, you know, people begin by thinking that if you want to accomplish a certain end, you can only do it one way. And so if you don't have access to the machine or you don't have access to the knowledge, you cannot get to this end. But of course, part of what we try to promote in the university is a kind of thinking that enables people to come up with alternative ways of getting to the same end. And so then your dependence on a particular way of operating is not so strong. Okay? And so that is also part of the question. That is part of the issue here. So it's a big picture. Okay? I was just talking about the political side here, but there's this issue also about the university as democratizing expertise in these various ways.
I don't have a strong claim to do about this problem, it's just an impression. But my impression is that the main problem of epistemic justice or injustice in science is the existence of lobbies, intellectual or scientific lobbies. If you are not a member of a lobby, you can't get a position. It's difficult to be published in a good review working in a certain domain. So how to do with this problem of lobbies if you agree that it is a big problem?
Yeah. There are several levels at which to deal with this matter. Let's start with the basic one. The basic one, first of all, is that people who are going to be scientists in the broad sense of being engaged in knowledge production should first of all learn as part of their training how to communicate in multiple media. So in other words, I mean, because these lobbies tend to be strong in certain kinds of media, stronger than in others. And as you know, we're now having a multiplication of media, internet, etc., social media. There are lots of ways to actually intervene now, but you have to be competent in the interventions. And so it becomes important that people be trained so that they can actually make their message clear and, you know, in many different forums and be able to organize across many different forums. That's one point. The other point is that I think that there is also a kind of a skepticism as well about the power of these lobbies, you know, kind of in the spirit of what you were talking about, where in a sense being identified very strongly with a particular lobby doesn't, you know, has its pluses and minuses as well. Okay? But I do think that you have to be competent in interacting in the various forums, because, and also be clear about what your goals are. What is it that you want to actually accomplish? And I do think that very often when we're talking about science, you know, you get a lot of complaints about scientists feeling they're not being heard or not being represented properly. But then I do think you need to ask these scientists, what is it that you're trying to get across exactly, and why should people listen, and what is the goal of this? Because I do think that those questions are very important ones to understand exactly the nature of the injustice. Right, because you can't really get the injustice understood properly unless you get a sense of, well, what is it that is being left out? What is it that is missing? What is it that people need to know that they're not hearing? Okay, and I think very often scientists aren't that clear about this. They're reacting rather at a more superficial level. You know, basically saying, I'm not being heard. I'm being misrepresented. But those facts aren't that interesting. Right? I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's not really that interesting by itself. The question is, what are the larger issues that your voice needs to play into that needs adequate representation? So that's how I would see the issue.
Thank you.